Federal Reserve says Americans owe more than $1 trillion in student debt. And that's not all. Data compiled by WalletHub finds Georgia leads most states with its rate of student debt. Now, listen to this. In Georgia, you can actually lose your job if you fall behind on your student loan payments, because defaulting can mean seizure of a state-issued professional license. For more on this, we turn to New York Times financial reporter Stacey Cowley. Morning, Stacey.
Hi there.
And Deborah Curry is here. She is a nurse in McDonough, Georgia. Her nursing license was seized in 2015 after she had problems paying her student loans. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning.
And Stacey, let me start with you. In how many states, including Georgia, can you actually have your state-issued professional license seized for defaulting? Is it just defaulting, or is it defaulting or falling behind on your student loan debt?
Generally, it's you have to fall significantly behind. So in many states, default is the trigger. And right now, it's 18 states where you can lose a license because of this.
You know, it used to be that, Stacey, that banks made these loans, right? And they were guaranteed by the federal government. Are states and the federal government both the guarantors of these loans now?
Yes, and that's why the states are the ones taking this action. Up through 2010, the banks made the loans, but the federal government insured them, and the federal government then turned to the states to reinsure its insurance. So if a student in that state defaulted, it was generally the state's taxpayers who were going to be on the hook for at least a portion of it. That's why the states started getting really serious and going after it with these sort of punitive tools to try to collect on these debts.
Yeah, you're right, really serious. We'll get to that in just a moment, and Deborah's story can help us get there. So, Deborah, you fell behind on your student loans essentially once you left the workforce to raise your children. Is that correct?
Right. I actually went to medical school and in the process had a total of 6 children.
Right.
I decided I wanted to be home and raise my kids instead of letting the daycare raise them.
Right.
And so then it was difficult to pay, you know, $170,000 worth of loans, because that's about what I had.
How much?
$170,000.
$170,000?
Yes, but I was paying back loans. I mean, you know, $1,700 a month at the time that I was notified by the Department of Justice in Georgia that I had defaulted in a loan.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me a certified letter in February of 2015 saying that, you know, I was behind or defaulted in a loan, gave me a chance to make arrangements.
And you did.
And I did. And my arrangements was like $50 a month. So it wasn't no problem. I could pay that.
Right.
I did everything I was supposed to do. I talked to them. I faxed everything over. I called them back just to verify that they got the facts and everything, because in the letter said that if I don't do what I need to do, that they would suspend my license.
But you got a second letter.
Then I got a second letter after I had done everything, and they even informed me that they had it.
And the letter says, accordingly, this is to advise you that your license was suspended on April 1st, 2015. April 1st, really?
April Fool's Day. Yeah. You know, it wasn't a joke, though.
And it was not a joke.
Yeah.
And you may not practice as a registered professional nurse. What do you do then?
Well, then, you know, I had so many mixed feelings. I didn't know what to do. It's like, you know, my livelihood is taken here. And it's like, you know, if I cannot work, then I certainly cannot, you know, pay any student loans.
But I don't understand. You made an arrangement and you were making good on the arrangement.
Right.
And yet your license was suspended.
Yeah, and so all I can do is call the people that I made the arrangements with and get somebody on the phone. It was very difficult to do that, and I got them on the phone, and needless to say, I was very irate because this is a serious issue. And, you know, it was like, hey, we talked. I did all this. You told me that you had it. And then I get this certified letter, and they was like, well, let me call you back.
Right.
And, you know, they called back another day and told me, oh, yes, you know, essentially, my bad. We did get it.
Right.
And, you know, somebody didn't pay attention. It was on their desk all the time.
Okay, so, Deborah, you're back to work. Are you back to work now?
Yes, I'm back to work.
Are you current on your student loan?
Yes.
How much do you still owe?
I still owe about $130,000.
All right, that's a whole other question I'm going to try to get to in a bit. So, Stacey, today, look, if If you were unable to keep current with your student debt, the country, right? The country's financial system punishes you pretty harshly. You get a horrible credit score, a garnishment of wages. So I'm wondering, what's the reasoning behind states essentially piling on, it feels, and stripping licenses? It seems counterproductive.
The reasoning is it's an effective tool. Louisiana had a case where they notified about 80 nurses that their licenses were going to be taken away, and all but three of them got current on their debts. Wow. So the reason for this is that it can motivate people when nothing else does. The catch of it is if you're one of those people who really, really can't pay, you know, taking away your only way of earning a paycheck and making any hope of making payments is really generally not seen as the best way to go about this. That's why some states have taken away these laws in recent years. We've seen four of them at least strike down these laws and take them off their books.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we're talking about student loan debt with Stacey Cowley of the New York Times and Deborah Curry, a nurse in McDonough, Georgia, who had her license stripped for a time because of student loan debt. So, Stacey, the problem of rising tuitions, rising debt, it seems to me, is only getting worse. We're talking about over $1 trillion in debt here. Isn't this a problem that is crying out for a federal fix?
It's certainly been described as a generational crisis. I mean, for students who are coming out of school now, this is something that haunts them for decades in many cases. And one stab that we did see at sort of a real fix on this is that for federal loans a few years ago, they adjusted the terms and made all of them eligible for income-based repayment options. So the idea there was to offer students a way of capping their payments at something that was by default affordable. It's generally about 10% of your income. Mm-hmm. So for anyone who's got federal loans, there is at least that option out there to explore. But one of the problems is for people who have private loans, those aren't subject to those same protections. So those are often where you see people really falling behind and, you know, drowning in this debt that they have very little hope of repaying if their income isn't high enough to do it.
Deborah, how are you going to—you're not going to be able to pay what you owe here. This is over $100,000. How are you going to ever get out from under that mountain of debt?
Well, excuse me, but one of the problems is the interest. They just keep piling on interest, and no matter how much you pay, it's like you can never catch up or— you know, the debt gets lowered because it's so much interest. I recently consolidated my loans. And even still, with consolidation, it's a $1,300 a month payment.
$1,300 a month payment?
Yes.
So, Stacey, what about that? I mean, you hear Deborah here. She's talking about, yes, there's the principal, but it's the interest that's really hurting her.
Yeah, and that's something we hear commonly as well, is interest rates on federal loans tend to be lower than, you know, interest rates on things like credit cards and things like that. But on the private loans, you can, again, get some really eye-popping interest rates. And even on those federal loans, you know, the interest really adds up. That's often something that we hear, that people make payments that are barely covering any principal. So it really stretches things out for quite a long time.
So, Stacey, I heard a lot of, well, I wouldn't say a lot. I heard some conversation about taking on this problem during the 2016 presidential campaign, but I haven't heard much about it since. Is anyone out there leading the fight to do something about this issue?
Well, it was certainly a talking point for a lot of Democratic candidates during the campaign. On the current DOE, DeVos, there's been very little talk about doing anything to relieve debt burdens. There's been actually some movement in the other direction to kind of scale back some of the forgiveness programs that are out there for students that make payments on their loans for quite a number of years. So, yeah, it doesn't seem like there's anything necessarily forthcoming from Washington on this front.
Deborah, are any of your children going to college, in college now? Are they taking on student loan debt? Are you worried about them?
Well, I have one son that's in college now. And yes, he's taking on some student loan debt. And it's concerning for everybody.
What's your advice to him?
To get a job and make sure that you have a repayment plan and pay your student loans.
Right, right. You know, Stacey, look, for many, the debt from the thing that is supposed to propel you to a better life, we're talking about a degree, is making it next to impossible, you know, for many people to acquire that dream, right? To buy a house, to open a business, to start a family, once they have that thing, a degree, right?
There's been some statistics coming out from various economic groups. You know, some state federal reserves have looked into this. And yeah, they have generally found some signs that things like household formation have been delayed for this generation because of the debts they're carrying from those college degrees.
Yeah. And is there any hard evidence that you've seen to suggest that, you know, this combination of rising tuition cost and debt are together putting higher education out of the reach of more people?
Well, I think it's clearly the rising tuition cost has been a huge factor. I mean, when you look at the $1.4 trillion that's currently owed in student loans, that has about quadrupled in the last 15 years. And that's pretty directly attributable to the rising costs behind it. So,
well, you mentioned that there are a number of states, first of all, that have these statutes, but some that have pulled them off the books. Do we know why?
Yeah, well, the most recent one was California. One interesting thing about these statutes is that in some states, they're very broad. Georgia's one of them. In Georgia, they can come after any professional license. In other states, the laws were written very narrowly, and they can only go after certain types of licenses. California was one of those. They could only go after certain types of medical and healthcare licenses. And again, there was a real bipartisan push. People decided this was not a law that made sense. And as of January 1st, it's gone. So they're one of the latest states to get rid of it. One of the states that's kind of gone in the opposite direction was South Dakota, just enacted this a couple years ago. They decided to crack down on debts owed to the state for unpaid bills at state universities, and they can now take your driver's license if you don't pay those. So mostly we've seen states moving in the direction of getting rid of these laws, but a few have started deciding this is a good idea and they'd like to expand it.
Yeah. Deborah, I'm wondering what your closing thoughts on this are. I mean, a college degree, advanced training in a craft is supposed to be your path, right, to the middle class.
Right.
Has it worked out for you?
Well, I mean, it's working, but it's very difficult. Financial survival is very difficult when you have, you know, so much money out there to pay and interest is just piling up on it. And, you know, you can't catch up.
Right. Deborah, thank you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Stacey Cowley of The New York Times. Stacey, thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Renowned novelist Harper Lee died in 2016. But Emory University is bringing a little-known part of her past to life. The author of To Kill a Mockingbird wrote a number of letters to friends between 1956 and 1961. Harper Lee's letters were acquired earlier this year by Emory University. Emory historian Professor Joe Crespino says the letters, quote, provide a window into her life and her views during a period of tumultuous change in Southern political life. Professor Crespino's latest book is titled Atticus Finch, The Biography. Joe, good to see you. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Let's go for about 12 minutes or so to answer your question.
Okay, great.
How many letters are we talking about, and what do we learn about Harper Lee from these letters?
Well, these are a fascinating set of letters in that they are written right before the period in which Harper Lee is about to write her two novels.
Yes.
She writes Ghost at a Watchman first, and then she writes To Kill a Mockingbird. So several of these letters are from 1956, when she is at home in Monroeville with her father, and with her family, but she's there to take care of her father because her father has had his first serious illness. And so one of the things that's fantastic about the letters is that we get to see this relationship between daughter and father, a relationship that clearly influences in a profound way both of the novels that she would end up writing. But there's some really poignant passages from the novels in which they are she's describing kind of what her father means to her.
Yeah.
And so we see her, you know, it's like for a lot of us, right, when we have our parents and they have their first kind of brush with death, we begin to reflect on their lives in new ways, and we kind of take stock of what they've meant to us. And that's what we see her doing in these letters in an interesting way.
So I don't want to get too long in the segment before we hear from one of the letters. So
I can read right here. This is a great example I'm talking about.
Outstanding.
Yeah. So this is her writing. Daddy is sitting beside me at the kitchen table, fully clothed and eating his 4 o'clock meal. He gets around the house with a walking stick, and Bear will soon drive him out to look at the high water on the golf course. While thinking of something to say to you, I found myself staring at his handsome old face, and a sudden wave of panic flashed through me. which I think was an echo of the fear and desolation that filled me when he was nearly dead. It has been years since I have lived with him on a day-to-day basis, and these months with him have strengthened my attachment to him, if such is possible. If he gets along every day like this, like he has today, it won't be long before I'll be back with you.
Hmm. Joe, how long have we known about the existence of these letters? And I'm wondering what other memorabilia is part of this collection.
Well, one of the things that's we've known the letters for a little bit. I mean, they were held by a private rare books dealer. And I came across them when I was doing research for my book. And I knew I wanted to look at them because what's great about them is we don't have a lot from Harper Lee during this particular period. In the late 1950s. And so that's what's interesting about them, and that's what's important about them. But one of the things that's great about them too is we can put them alongside other sources. That, for example, when we know that she's home in 1956, now we can go and do research in the local newspaper. And that's one of the things I've done to look at kind of what's going on in Monroeville. And this is a very critical moment in the history of the civil rights movement in the Deep South.
Yeah.
Well, what's going on in Alabama is that kind of the era of massive resistance is really starting up full bore. 1956 is a critical year for Alabama. You've got Arthurine Lucy is the first African-American woman who's coming into the University of Alabama. That's calling all kinds of struggles. There's the boycott in Montgomery that's been going on, that is playing out in the Supreme Courts. So this is causing all kinds of reactionary politics to emerge in Alabama and the Deep South. And this is when, politics in the South are really polarizing, and you begin to see the rise of an organization like the Citizens Councils, the White Citizens Councils, right? And this is supposedly the kind of the white-collar Klan. These are the responsible folks who are supposed to kind of keep down the hotheads and lead this kind of peaceful resistance to the civil rights movement. But that's not happening. And what's happening in Alabama in 1956 and 57 and 58, when she's writing these novels and then revising them, is it's not the kind of the moderate white citizens councils that's keeping the Klan in check, but really what's happening is the Klan is radicalizing the moderates and the white citizens councils. And so in some ways, I think this process of what's happening on the ground in Alabama is really shaping the context of how she's revising her two novels.
So I want to get to a soundbite from Harper Lee in a moment, but first, if you're just joining us, we're having a fascinating conversation with Joe Crispino from Emory University. The university acquired the letters from Harper Lee, and they're now available to the public. Let's listen to Harper Lee describing what she loves to do.
You know, so many writers don't like to write. I think that's their chief complaint. They hate to write. They must. They do it under the compulsion that makes any artist what he is, but they really don't enjoy sitting down and trying to turn a thought into a reasonable sentence. But I do, I like to write, and sometimes I'm afraid that I like it too much because when I get into work, I don't want to leave it. And as a result, I'll go for days and days and days without leaving my house, wherever I am. I'll just go out long enough to get the papers and get some food, and that'll be it. It's strange.
Wow. Joe, how important are these letters, and how great is it to be able to make them available to the public?
Well, it's wonderful because Harper Lee is such a beloved figure, and the novel To Kill a Mockingbird is really one of kind of America's shared stories. So many people read that and they're assigned it because it's a book that we want to teach kids about kind of racial morality, and it's how kids learn. But now we have a way of kind of knowing more about the context in which she's writing that novel, right? And that's important. So we can kind of enrich our understanding of her literature and its importance and think in more complicated ways about its relevance for us today.
That is author and historian Joe Crispino from Emory University. The university acquired letters from author Harper Lee. They are now available to the public in the Rose Library at Emory. And Joe has just finished his book, Atticus Finch, the biography, And you can hear him talk more about it on Two-Way Street with Bill Nigut. That is next month. Joe, a pleasure.
Thanks so much
Thank
for having
you.
Me.
Thank
Appreciate
you. That was fun.
It.
Thank you.
Yep.
An ex-Atlanta Hawks employee is suing the team for racial discrimination. Margot Klein, who is white, claims the team's external affairs director was discriminatory against her and fellow white employees. So to be clear here, the term reverse racism is not expressly included in federal civil rights laws. Lawsuits claiming reverse discrimination or reverse racism are generally brought as discrimination cases under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. However, when a racial discrimination suit claims discrimination against white people, well, you know how that hits the bloodstream of today's politics. So let's talk about it. With us in studio is Kenyette Tisha Barnes. She is the policy director with the Georgia Alliance for Social Justice, and LaSalle University sociology professor Charles Gallagher is with us from Philadelphia. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank Good
you
morning.
For having me.
So, Professor, let me start with you. What is reverse racism? There is, as I mentioned, nothing in the law called reverse discrimination or reverse racism. So deconstruct this term for us.
Yeah, reverse racism is, I mean, in its simplest manifestation is racism that's alleged to take directed at the dominant group, and in this case, whites. So that's when we say reverse racism, it really means racism directed at white people because they're white. But, you know, the real, again, the problem is reverse racism is really, I think, in some ways, it's a red herring. It's to suggest that there is systemic, sustained racism directed at whites because of their skin color. It's just not borne out by the data. What it really is, I think, is a narrative that is a response to perceived threat. Now, in this particular case, certainly someone, this woman, could have been the target of racism because she's white. But that does not mean that there is systemic, institutionalized racism against white people. In this particular case, you know, and to be clear, anyone can be racist at the individual level.
Yes.
But at the institutional level, it just doesn't bear out because, quite honestly, this is a white country run by whites, mostly men, and they are in positions of power. So their racial minorities typically aren't in a situation where they can systemically collectively discriminate against white people.
So, Professor, let's put a really fine point on it because you are speaking to a question I have here. So let's go here. Is there any peer-reviewed reporting that suggests blacks and other non-whites are discriminating against whites in a widespread or systemic way in the area of employment and promotions in this country?
Not to my knowledge, and this is an area that I know quite well. We could flip that around, and I could show you dozens of studies where racism still plays out in the housing market, in financial institutions, in banks that are directed at racial minorities. So the reverse of this is just not true. There is nothing in the literature to suggest that reverse racism is something that happens in any kind of regular basis. Again, at the individual level,
sure.
Anybody can be racist to anyone, you know, and that's at the individual level. So in fact, this person might be making a valid claim that she was targeted because of her gender and because of her race. But there is nothing in the literature to suggest that reverse racism is something basically that is infecting labor practices.
So, Kenyette, when you hear this term, right, this phrase, reverse discrimination, reverse racism, what's your reaction?
It's merely hyperbole masquerading as an outrage.
Okay.
So what I want to do first is give some vocabulary. I mean, I think we're using the term racism almost like social justice duct tape. I mean, it's not an end-all word. So when you have situations where you have black people in power, mostly situational employment situations, that's prejudice and that's discrimination. Yes, if someone who is black is your boss and they fire you because you're white and they might not like you, you have a claim for discrimination. Is that racism? No. So I think what we really need to do is we have to be careful with the terminology.
Yeah. With the language.
With the language. Racism is systemic, as the professor said, and I agree with the professor 100%. It's systemic. And, you know, there's no peer-reviewed study to say that there has been systemic racism against white people by any minority race in employment,
right.
education, health care, criminal justice practices. So once again, I think it's just, you know, much ado about nothing, and it's merely hyperbole masquerading as an outrage.
Well, Professor, we found a 2011 CNN article where you're quoted saying, we went from being a privileged group to all of a sudden becoming whites, the new victims. So explain to me how that happened. What's the reasoning behind white victimization?
Yeah, I think what has happened is that a big segment of the white population, it feels threatened. And I think that it's been used by the Trump administration to make white males in particular feel very uneasy about the America they live in. I mean, for one example that I think is an interesting number that most Americans, and I'm speaking whites here, they overestimate the black population by almost threefold. The average American thinks that 38% of the population is foreign-born. It's actually about 13%. They overestimate the size of the Latino population. So for a lot of whites, their perception is that those groups are taking over. And this is the threat. And I think a lot of the response, the reverse racism, why people go apoplectic about this, is because it's a response to a perceived threat. And the threat is that whites are basically losing their privilege and their status. And, of course, that is just wholly ridiculous. Congress is white. 90% of elected officials are white. 94% of all Fortune 500 companies are white. 75% of doctors are white. 87% of college presidents are white. We live in a white country that's run by white men, but they're seeing their power as slipping. That's the perception.
Yeah. Yeah. In response to the suit from Ms. Margot Klein, the Atlanta Hawks said, we take all claims of discrimination seriously and have performed a thorough review of these baseless claims. The case was quickly dismissed at the EEOC level. We deny these claims and will vigorously defend against them. Kenya, the president tweeted that the TV show Black-ish is, quote, racism at highest level. Is the president asking America or just whites in America to believe in this notion of reverse racism?
Well, first of all, we need a deck of tarot cards to figure out what our president is saying. First of all, I think once again, in order to address the president's tweet, I do not believe this is a case where we need to take a look in the mirror and we need to acknowledge that there's some sort of reverse racism going. What I will say is, to the professor's point about a perceived threat, in order for there to be a perceived threat, you have to have acknowledged a position of power and dominance. And that's just clear strategy. That's just clear tactical defense. So one of the things that I often find with this reverse racism conversation is that the people who purport to have experienced reverse racism or that there is reverse racism tend to deny the original racism because you got to have that first, and also tend to deny white privilege.
And let's leave it there. Thank you both so much. That's Kenyette Tisha Barnes of the Georgia Alliance for Social Justice. And we've also been listening to Charles Gallagher, a sociology professor at LaSalle University. Thank you both. Thank you both for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Tomorrow, we revisit the moment when President Jimmy Carter posthumously was awarded Martin Luther King Jr. the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This week, we pay tribute to King to mark 50 years since his death. How would you describe his legacy? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter. Our handle is at OST Talk, and be sure to join the program tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Americans take to the streets to voice their anger, declare their despair, and call for change for a lot of reasons. Last month, young people led the demonstrations against continuing gun violence following the Parkland school shooting in Florida. Yolanda King, the granddaughter of Dr. King, added her voice to the cries for gun control.
My grandfather had a dream will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that enough is enough. And that this should be a gun-free world. Period.
Period. Okay. Hollywood voiced its Me Too movement after actresses came forward with sexual misconduct allegations. Actress Viola Davis spoke up for those affected.
I am speaking today, not just for the Me Toos, because I was a Me Too. But when I raise my hand, I am aware of all the women who are still in silence.
The 1960s saw and heard the most famous and remembered speech of the civil rights movement at a march in Washington, D.C.
I have a dream that one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
But how effective are marches in sparking real and lasting change? I'm joined by three guests. Coco Pappy is a community organizer based in Savannah. Anjali Injeti is an Atlanta-based freelance writer and activist. And civil rights historian Derek Gilliard is here with us as well. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, thank you for having me.
Coco, let me start with you. What was the first march you remember organizing? Let me start there.
The first march I ever organized was the Women's March last year. And so it was a Georgia State team. It was myself, Hillary Holly, Lindsay Arundel, Naja Payne, and a handful of other really moved women who were just kind of like, this is something we have to do, right?
Yeah, what was the most difficult aspect of organizing the rally?
So I actually think that organizing the march isn't the hard part. I think the hard part is actually getting people to move into the secondary action, right? So showing up and marching and yelling and holding the sign is great. It's a great first entry point. But I think then it's how do you show people that there's more work to be done than just marching, right? Like, what
right,
do you do
right.
next? How do you move forward?
What's next? The secondary movement. Anjali, let me bring you in here. What was your... let's call it your awakening moment in activism.
You know, I've been an activist for a fair amount of time, but I think, generally speaking, there have been a number of incidents in the Asian American community that have caused this sort of awakening, this very recent awakening. You know, we had a couple of years ago, we had the brutal assault of a 57-year-old Indian grandfather in Madison, Alabama, by a police officer. Leaving Suresh Bhai Patel partially paralyzed. We had the shooting death of Srinivas Kochabadla in Olathe, Kansas. Last year, he was told to get out of the country. We've had the burning of Islamic temple. So there have been quite a number of events leading up to and following the election of President Trump, and I think we're seeing quite a few members of the Asian American community in engaging in these marches now that we haven't before.
Derek, I'm going to bring you in here in a second, but because you can give us some perspective here that'll be useful, I think. But Coco, what did you think of the March for Our Lives rally?
So I think it's great. I think it's a way for young people to really enter the fold. And I think it's a really great entry point for people who maybe don't consider themselves political or activists or organizers to move into that first step, right? But again, going back to my original point, it's not all you can do, right? What is it that comes next? And if you can't, I would say something that the Parkland students have done really well is instead of focusing on the federal level, what can you do at the state level, right? How can you affect your state officials? What can you do at the local level? How can you bring attention to this issue in a way that's, I would sort of call it playing inside ball and outside ball, right? Like, what can you do on the outside to agitate? And then what can you do on the inside to work with lawmakers and policymakers to really push your issue forward and make sure that it's heard and puts it in a way that's actionable?
When you, Derek, when you hear the young voices in the March for Our Lives rally and that movement, planning, organizing events, what memories come rushing back to you?
It's great to see it because basically the activists of the 50s and the 60s, certainly Dr. King's crew, they were all young people. And then they founded SNCC, which was all college students. And so young people will move the needle. They have less to lose. They're not married. They don't have families. But it was great to see them get engaged because I think they'd been on the sidelines for too long. And there had to be an issue that moved the needle for them. And this is it.
Yeah. Quiz time. You guys ready for a little quiz?
Sure.
Sure.
So listen to this from New York Magazine. And, you know, Coco, this will make your point. So I'll give you an opportunity to say it again and again and again. So this is from New York Magazine. An estimated 750,000 people listened to a series of speakers, some of whom had lost friends and family members to gun violence. What march am I talking about? Thank you. The silence says it all. That was the Million Mom March of 2000. Okay. So, Coco, to your point, the secondary movement, the marching is not enough, is it?
It's not. I really don't believe it is. And so specifically, I think with the March for Lives, which is very fresh in everyone's conscious, it's then asking, what does gun violence look like in your specific community, right? Because gun violence doesn't look the same in everyone's community. So it's asking who is most affected, how can we center those voices, and what is the work that we can do to sort of push that forward?
So I don't have a whole lot of time in my life. You guys don't either, okay? No one listening does. How many movements can the collective in this country process? And are we becoming as niche in our protest movements as we are in say, our media consumption, Anjali?
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I think what was introduced with the recent March for Our Lives was intersectionality, solidarity. Really centering.
What does that mean, intersectionality?
So I think intersectionality to me is really centering and focusing on the groups who are most marginalized, who are at the brunt of very negative and harmful policies and laws. And I think we saw some of that at the March for Lives, which making sure that Black and Indigenous and Latinx voices were sort of the heart and soul for that. And I think we need to continue in that direction. I think that marginalized groups should be uplifted, their voices. And I think the rest of us need to serve as better allies and examine the ways that we, whether we are interrogating our own white supremacy and our own sort of racism, and making sure that we are giving platforms to people who are most affected.
We are looking at political marches with activists Coco Pappy and Anjali Njeti. We made a little room for civil rights historian Derek Gilliard as well. Derek, are you concerned that we can burn out on all kinds of things in the society, that we'll burn out on protest movements?
We can. I think it really comes down to where the genesis of why you're doing it is rooted. Because I tell you, as I look, and we're losing them every week, the civil rights giants and the people that were the foot soldiers, Rita Samuels, who just died and will be funeralized on Saturday, these people, to their dying day, were on the front line, and they continued to work. And so there was something that motivated them to not make it a passing fancy.
Yeah. Coco, your thoughts on that?
So I think about it. It's really, what can you do in this moment right now? So say you can't go to a march because you have work or it's not ADA accessible. What can you do, right? So I think it's finding the thing that you really want to put your energy, your limited energy and time behind, and pushing forth in any free space you can, right? So like the thing that I'm really encouraging people to do right now is get behind candidates that you really believe in, right? So like with Georgia's win list, we've put some really amazing women in office, Bea Nugent, Deborah Gonzalez, because those women reflect that our values that we really need to prioritize, right? We know those women will fight for us. So then it's like, okay, who at the state level, who at the local level can you put into office, and how can you get behind them?
Yeah. Anjali, I wonder, in your activism work, were there lessons from the civil rights movement that you applied to the way you approach what you do in activism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we as activists come with a very rich history. We have people in our history who have laid the groundwork. And to Coco's point, I mean, part of that is you march and then you go to the polls. And I think that's an important legacy of the civil rights movement. I mean, voting rights was at the heart of the civil rights movement. And we have very disturbing present day issues with voter integrity and election integrity. So I think that second necessary step is being is something that we should enforce and, you know, get behind your political candidates and continue to make your voice heard through the election process.
So, Derek, some of the lessons from the civil rights movement to be passed on, right, to this generation. Focus on issues, not personalities.
Yes.
Pressure specific companies and agencies.
Sure. Coalition building.
Preparation matters. Optics. Everything has to, civility matters.
Absolutely.
Is this all making sense, Coco?
I would agree. I think it's not what you say, it's how you say it, right? How do you tell the truth in a way that people will hear you, right? How do you show up in a way that people will hear you? I mean, this really, we've got such, especially in Georgia, we've got such a rich history that we can reference, that we can move back into, that we can look and see what strategies worked, right? Like Sunday pew sit-ins were a really great tactic by the civil rights movement, right? So how can we translate that to the modern day, you know, actions that we're really trying to push, right? We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can find the leaders, we can find the elders in our community who have done the work and learn from them. We can get community organizing trainings, right? It's really about knowing what resources are out there and tapping into those and then sharing them with your community, right?
Yeah. I'm wondering if you feel, Anjali, that the fact that the Never Again movement, right, led by the students who survived at the Parkland shooting,
mm-hmm.
Does it suggest that these young people today, your generation, Coco's generation, will not be deterred by politics as usual?
You know, it's hard to say. I think our political system right now is very, you know, it's very tough to get involved.
Fractured,
yes.
Broken.
That's an excellent word. Fractured. We are fractured. We are frazzled. And sometimes it's like drinking water from a garden hose. I think having sort of short-term goals, you know, helping out with specific races, for one thing. I know that a lot of youth in my area, organizing for a march can be a sort of finite thing. But then looking to the next step, I mean, we have November elections coming up. They're right around the corner. The primaries for those elections are right around the corner. So I think three steps ahead is a good strategy. Knowing what you're going to do today, what you'll be doing next month, and what you'll be doing, you know, next year in the work.
And Coco, realistic expectations?
So I think, yes to all those points. I think something that's also really important to highlight is cultural understanding, right? We all do not come to this work in the same way. We all do not have the same experience. And so something that I think we need to kind of speak on is the reaction to March of Lies versus, I would say, the reaction to Stephen Clark's death in California, right? How are we treating one group versus the other? Where are the indiscrepancies? And how can we better support things, right, when they're harder to talk about, when they, you know, dig up deeper issues, right? So how do we talk about that and how do we support that?
Yeah. Thank you all. I really enjoyed
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Coco Pappy, a community organizer in Savannah. Anjali Njeti is a freelance writer based right here in Atlanta, and to civil rights historian Derek Gilliard. Derek, good to see you.
Good to see you.
It's been a while. Thanks for your time to all of you.
Thank
and that
you.
Is our program for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. Have you marched for a cause? Tell us about it. You can give us a ring at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.